Welcome to Rails with Jason. If you enjoyed today's episode and want more Rails tips and advice, head over to codewithjason.com, where I keep all my Rails articles and videos. Now on to the episode. Hey, today my guest is Andy Kroll. Andy, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here. Do you want to tell us who you are?
Who I am? This is a difficult question for me. My day job is I work as the CTO of CoverageBook, which is a very small software SaaS business for the PR industry based in Brighton in the UK. I run Brighton Ruby, which is a conference, and this year an online event. And I also was running a fortnightly newsletter called One Ruby Thing, where I was sort of like capturing my various PR, my pull request stuff, and writing up as an email for people every 2 weeks. But events somewhat overtook me this year, so I do plan to get back to that. But yeah, that's it.
Yeah, events have overtaken a lot of things lately. to put it mildly. Yeah. So how long have you been doing Brighton Ruby?
So Brighton Ruby would have been year 7 this year. And before that, I ran a conference in Singapore where I was living called Red Dot Ruby Conference. And I ran that for 2 years before handing it over when I moved home.
Oh, wow.
To the UK.
And what did you go to Singapore for?
I went as a trailing spouse. So my other half got a job soon after we got married. And she's always been the sort to put her hand up when someone says, can anyone go to X? And she's always gone, yeah, sure, why not? And so we went for 6 months and stayed for 6 years. Got to know some really great Ruby and Rails folks out in Singapore and Malaysia and the wider Southeast Asian scene, I suppose. And some of the Aussies and stuff as well. So it was a really good experience.
Yeah, it occurred to me the other day that I don't know where Singapore is. I couldn't find it on a map. And so I'm like, where the heck is this place? And it's like, it's at the southern tip of Malaysia, right?
Yeah, that's right. It's sort of India and then right. It's right on the equator, 27 degrees all the time, roasting hot or thundering rainstorms.
I need to do the conversion for my American listeners. 27 degrees Celsius, is 80 degrees Fahrenheit. That's not too hot. Is it humid there, though?
It's a close heat, yeah.
Okay.
It takes 3 years for me to start wearing jeans in the daytime.
Yeah. And then since spicy food is a topic that we've talked about on the podcast before, is the food there spicy? Are you a spicy food kind of person?
I am. Singapore's food is extraordinary. It has both really great cuisine itself, plus it imports cuisine from all over Southeast Asia. So like just terrific food from $3 a meal to $300 a meal, broadly speaking, whatever you want to eat. And eating is effectively a hobby in Singapore. So I would recommend anyone who gets the chance to go there to just sort of go there and spend the week eating and lying down.
Yeah, I can imagine that would be a great experience. I would definitely be into that. Okay, so you went to Singapore. You had this Red Dot Ruby conference. Did people come to that, like from all over the world, or was it mostly local people, or what?
Well, the story of how it happened was I had said at the local Ruby meetup, oh, you know, we should have a conference. I was very jealous at the time of the sort of regional conferences in the US, and I said we should have a conference, and they're like, yeah, Andy, you should organize it. So I emailed Matt and said, I'm thinking of putting on a conference. Would you be interested in coming? And he said, yes.
Wow.
And therefore I had to put on a conference. So it's all Matt's fault.
What level of courage did that require on your part? Was it like not a big deal to you to ask Matt to come, or did you have to like work up to it, or what?
I knew from some friends of mine who knew him a little or had met him a few times that he was a very friendly guy. So I just relied on the anonymity of email. So it was good. And basically built the conference around that. And we had 200 or 300 people the first year. And then again, the second year. And Brighton Ruby's been a sort of similar size since I've been back to the UK. So yeah, it's always been those sort of like medium sized conferences for me. Anyway.
Yeah, those small conferences are, I've really enjoyed them. Like I went to Southeast Ruby last year, 2019 in Nashville. And that was a great conference because it was nice and small, just like maybe a couple hundred people.
Yeah.
The venue was kind of a smaller, intimate venue. Those ones I really like because you have a chance to actually talk to some people. I went to my first RailsConf in 2019 also. Man, I'm glad that I got that. So like I went to a bunch of conferences in 2019. I had never really like gone to a lot of conferences before. I'm so glad that I got that out of the way when I did. This is just occurring to me now because like obviously now I'm not having the chance to in 2020. But yeah, those small ones are great. At RailsConf, there were like thousands of people there or whatever. And like, I even like knew like a good handful of people who like I knew from online who were going to be there. And I like couldn't find them because there was so many people there.
Yeah, it's a good 1,800-ish at RailsConf. That's the biggest one. And, you know, six tracks and multiple days. And frankly, as an organizer, that horrifies me. The team at Ruby Central do an awesome job with it, but it scares me a lot.
Yeah, you have to work the whole year round just to have that conference for those three days or whatever. Yeah. Speaking of, we mentioned Matt's a minute ago. I've met Matt's a couple times. I met him at RubyConf India in 2019 and then later in Salt Lake City at Ruby Hack also in 2019. And I've had some like big Ruby people on the show, like Sandy Metz, Mike Parham. Mm. But the two people I haven't had who are like the most obvious two people on the list are DHH and Metz.
Yeah.
And I invited DHH. This was like earlier this year in 2020. And his response was really funny. He said, well, I'm really busy working on Hey.com right now, but I'm happy to consider it in 2021.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which was great because like it was totally sincere, you know, like sure, maybe in 2021. I'm happy to talk about it again at that time. And so I actually put a calendar item on my calendar the first business day of 2021. I have a reminder to myself to reach back out to DHH and invite him on the show.
Yeah, no, he's I always invite him to Brighton Ruby and he always very politely declines. Mm-hmm. I tried to get Matt a couple of times, just schedules didn't work out. And hopefully when things get back to more in-person meetings, then Matt's is definitely on my wish list, as is Sandy Matt's. She's again, scheduling has prevented her from ever coming to Brighton Ruby, but one day soon, we'll see.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was my DHH invitation. I invited Matt's. Still looking forward to receiving a response at some point, but maybe I'll try again in a couple months or something like that. We were talking about conferences. You did a couple there in Singapore, and apparently you had a sufficiently good experience to keep doing it and start doing it there in England.
Yeah, sufficiently good. Yes, I would say... I knew how to run the sort of conference I like to go to and can manage mostly as one person. When I returned to the UK, so basically I learned Ruby and Rails and sort of started my career in Ruby and Rails in Singapore. So when I moved back to the UK, I didn't have any sort of network at all. And I had young children on the way. So I thought that the best thing to do was to sort of create a big stink and, organized a conference, but there wasn't one in the UK at the time. So I started up a conference in the first year. We had 150 people and sort of grown it a little bit most years, and some years it's fallen back. But it was broadly speaking, it was like I just needed to meet other Rubyists, both for work purposes and also for my own sanity. So
what year?
So it turns out this would have been 2000 and must have been 2014. Yeah, because 2013, I hadn't moved to Brighton yet. So yeah, I sort of started organizing in January 2014, and it's always in the summer. Brighton's on the coast in the UK, and the weather's pretty nice, and ice cream's on the beach and that kind of thing. So there's a good reason to come down in July.
Okay.
From the rest of the UK.
No Ruby conference at all in England at that time.
No, there had been attempts, and there's always been a London Ruby group and a Northwest Ruby group and various local things. There'd been a couple in Scotland earlier on. There was a strong consultancy in Scotland that used to run Scott Ruby, but there hadn't been for a year or two in the UK. And I don't think there'd ever been sort of like a UK-wide one. So there was a hole, and I knew how to do it, and I needed to meet people. So I just volunteered because I was consulting at the time. So I needed to branch out and meet folks. So
yeah, I've had the thought cross my mind to have like a regional Ruby conference in Detroit or something like that, because I live here in Michigan, although on the west side of the state. But so far, I'm not sufficiently masochist to take on that undertaking.
I mean, I'm pretty good at managing my own stress levels now. I sort of do it throughout the year, and I've got emails that I wrote before for last year, so I can always, I'm in the copying and pasting era. I'm in the Stack Overflow era of my own conference organizing. It's relatively manageable. The last 2 weeks are hellish, but the feeling on the day and the day after is pretty good. And then I don't have to think about it for 3 or 4 months afterwards. So that's a win.
Taking your most recent in-person year, 2019, what was the attendance like around then? Has it grown since then from the original 150 to more, or has it stayed about the same size?
Yeah. I mean, the last 3 years, it's been sort of 300 to 350 most years for the last two or three. And it seems to have sort of stabilized at that size. I wouldn't want it much bigger than that. You start to lose some of the intimacy of the single track and the everyone watching the same stuff, and you end up in a sort of level of complexity as well from an organizing perspective, which means I'd have to involve a team, or it would just be much harder to run a much bigger conference and guarantee the same sort of handmade feel that I sort of aim for with my event.
Yeah. Right now, is it just you doing the organizing?
It's always just been me. I'm a very simple man with very, very bad planning.
that's probably how I would want to do it too.
Yeah. Benevolent dictator for life.
It's a
coding term, but also an organizing and event related term.
And how did you get the word out for like, hey, I'm having a conference, please buy a ticket?
Well, I mean, the trick for me, when you're organizing something, it's like you organize for the version. I could have run it with 50 people the first year. And okay. I was pretty confident there were 50 people in the UK who would come down. So like you have it scalable from that level. Like I think a mistake that lots of people make when they do their first event is they're just like, they go big. And it's like when you're writing code, you make it work first. The first year, 150 was more than I'd hoped for. And I'd booked a room that could only take that many. But it would have worked financially with 50. And so each year it's grown a little bit, and that seems to be a sustainable way to do it. Like I just make sure that I don't lose money. I never make a huge amount of money, but like,
approach it.
Well, it's a way that avoids any awkward conversations with my other half.
Yeah.
You spent all these days and evenings doing this and now we owe them money. Brilliant. that's the key thing for me is like, Keep it small and manageable, and put the effort in, and don't necessarily throw money at problems.
Yeah, that's my other fear that's holding me back from starting my own conference, coronavirus notwithstanding, is like I'm afraid of throwing a conference and then it actually costs money instead of... I'm never expecting... everything I hear from conference organizers is like, it's if you want to make money, that's not like... a great way to make money. You pretty much like you can break even or like maybe make a little bit of money, but you're not like rolling in your gold coins like Scrooge McDuck or whatever.
There's no Scrooge McDucking as a result of Brighton Ruby. It's a weird one. It's like you have to be on the cash flow because that's super important. But like you can't sort of make loads of, the only ones that really make money are massive, massive events. So that's what you see is when you see an event. So for example, there's an event called the Lead Dev, which they started in London for lead developers, which is a really smart idea. And I really wish I'd had it. But what they had to, what they've done is now it's multiple cities or was, and now it's, you know, they went from like a 200 person one the first year to 400 to like 1,000 to like 1,500. So it's, they were a conference business. And so what you see is the conferences that really make money are the gigantic ones. But again, as a solo person whose main job is putting forms on websites, I don't want to do that. So yeah, I kind of keep it small, keep it nice, keep it as a sort of event that I would want to attend.
Yeah, that kind of thing is kind of like, this is what I want to do with my life. I want to be a conference organizer, and that is my, that's my occupation.
Yeah,
and that's for me not the path that I want to go down.
No. Yeah. I'm actually really interested in, I'd really like to do, and this might actually come to pass next year, I'd like to do an event for like 20 people.
Yeah.
And like see how you could do that, like almost like a retreat or, because I know there's things like Rails Camp in sort of started out of Australia. Sort of exported around the world, but like I'd really like to see sort of a like a 10 or 15 or 20 person conference where like it's more of a, everyone brings a talk and then you discuss it afterwards, and you know, you don't put any less effort in, but it's more of a small scale event, and I've never seen anything quite like that, so I think that would be really interesting.
Yeah,
and maybe that's all we'll be allowed to do in the coming years. So so Brian Ruby Micro, who knows?
Yeah, you know, I'm imagining a conference that I could have here in Michigan. I mentioned Detroit. This could take place like in the Upper Peninsula where it's wilderness. Mm. Maybe sell 20 tickets and we go up and each person gets a rifle and a pack of matches and a water canteen. And we say, okay, we're going to drop you off at this spot. We'll see you in 5 days, and then those of us who survive will have a really great story to tell.
That's true. It's sort of the Hunger Games version of a Ruby conference.
Yeah, I mean, we're not going to kill each other. The rifle is the rifle is for deer or, you know, bears, whatever. But you know, even so, you might not come back, which I think would be part of the appeal.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Okay. So that's the conference stuff. What do you do for work?
So I run a small team, small tech team in Brighton. We have two products, Coverage Book and Answer the Public. So two Rails apps. We serve about 3,000 customers with a tech team of four, and an entire company of 10. We are bootstrapped. We are profitable, and we sort of use the businesses to be civilized, I suppose. Sort of enjoy our work, do great work as much as we can, and support all of those customers, but with a really tiny team, which is something I don't see very much of. And you know, part of that is selfishly, I still like to code. So you know, I've been in bigger teams before, and they're fine, they're good. You know, you meet loads of cool people, and but it's a very different job to, you know, continuing to be an individual contributor and sort of lead the tech, but not have lots of sort of managerial or team-based responsibilities.
How long have you worked there?
So I contracted for a couple of years, and I've been there nearly two as a sort of, as an employee. So yeah, it's a really great company, really good people, loads of problems, with the code base. You know, it was built very quickly by a team who were learning Rails at the same time. So a lot of what I've been doing and
so
why I was
originally, really good.
It's getting there now.
Yeah.
I've spent, you know, the last, you know, few years enabling the amount of growth that we're able to see. Like, you know, we have, you know, 3,000 customers is a lot. One of our apps, Answer the Public, is a sort of freemium thing. So we serve 300,000 visitors a month from across the world with this thing. And then we have sort of, you know, 1,000 customers who pay us for the sort of enhanced version. So yeah, there's sort of all sorts of interesting challenges to running that with a small team whilst also remaining calm and together and not having to get paged in the night too much and all of those sorts of things. So yeah, it's a really interesting, it's a sort of challenge we've set ourselves by sort of limiting hiring as much as we possibly can and trying to be smart and throwing money at problems where we don't want to solve them with our own in-house technology. So, you know, we're a big Heroku customer, we're big customer of Sidekick, and you know, all these things that we can do to sort of somewhat emulate how Basecamp do things. Obviously they're a different scale again, but trying to keep that product team as small as we can is super important to us.
Got it. So just to paint the picture of the history a little more, how long had the app been developed before you started there?
So I rocked up about 2 years after, 2 or 3 years after the first commit. They weren't quite profitable at that point. There was about 600 customers on one of the apps, and the other app didn't exist yet. Well, it did exist, but only as sort of like a marketing tool for the other app. So they basically spun out of a PR agency. One of the sort of senior people in the agency, Gary, wanted to get into product and had sort of been reading about SaaS and 37 Signals and all that kind of world and wanted to explore that. And so a friend of mine, John, was working, helped them sort of run incubators inside their business. And the sort of the founders of that business effectively invested in themselves and the people inside the company who wanted to go on this new adventure, I suppose. And yeah, so it was getting to profitability, but then nobody took huge pay cuts. It wasn't like it was sort of the opposite of a startup story. And they had some success early, but like, you know, it takes a long time to build a business, but then the good thing about those businesses is they take a long time to kill as well. So, now we're in a good place, and trying to serve our customers much better with all the things that we know they want. So, yeah, that's kind of what drives me.
Yeah, interesting. So one of the remarkable things to me about that story is that the people who started this business they've discovered the 37 Signals work and they said, hey, I want to do this. I want to start my own product business. And they did it and it actually worked because it's really hard to do that. Like, I've in my research and my attempts to start a successful online business, I've discovered that it's really hard to start an online business on purpose. And what I mean by that is, like, for people who start with no idea or anything and they say, I want to make money online, and then they try to do something, like, probably fewer than 1% of those people actually succeed in doing that. And most of the people I observe who have something that's successful, they kind of started it accidentally. Like, the example I always use is this company called MoreAware. They do scheduling for countertop fabricators. It's like nobody ever would have like sat down with a notepad and been like, okay, what am I going to do? Like, scheduling for hair salons, or like a restaurant menu app, or like a countertop fabricators, that's the ticket. Like, no, nobody would ever brainstorm that up. It's just that somebody's like brother-in-law or something was a countertop fabricator, and so they recognized that issue and they stumbled into it. It's really hard to say, I want to have a business and then actually make it happen.
Yeah, I mean, they struggled initially. Like, I wasn't there for this part, but they built out, you know, they did the standard thing which agencies do, which is they built a CRM for their industry. And they actually had some success with it. Like, they understood their industry well enough to have some success. And then they worked out very quickly that they were pitching to really big companies and getting some interest, but like, they didn't want to build a sales team. They didn't want it. It wasn't what they got into it for, was to, you know, build a big enterprisey sales team. So but there was one corner of the product that people sort of leant forward when they were doing their sort of enterprisey sales demos. I mean, I use enterprise in the loosest term here, but they sort of leant forward on this coverage book thing, which is reporting on the success or failure of your coverage as a PR company or internal team. And people leant in going, well,
That's something that like no developer would have dreamed up. You have to be in that domain in order to even be aware of that opportunity.
And I don't think they were aware, to be honest. And certainly the story of our second product was something that Gary used to do for people and that Dan from our team had knocked up a version of. And then I helped Dan rebuild it so that it scaled to the number of people who were now using it and finding, you know, finding value in it. And then effectively, you know, over 3 weeks, we stuck a credit card form on it. And then, and purely due to the size of the audience who had found it, and it had a kind of a unique marketing page. Like if you go to the homepage, there's a kind of a creepy guy staring at you as you enter your search term. So yeah, there's lots of interesting, unique things, and Gary's a terrific marketer. And I think they just found the right people along the way. Like people in the team, in the agency, sort of changed jobs to do other things. Like Dan was a SEO consultant, and they found me at the right time for them when they were, you know, they were really having scaling issues and the app was falling down all the time and they didn't know how to structure things. So like I came in and provided some stability to that.
How did they find you?
Through my friend John, who was working, who was a Rails developer and, you know, sort of perennial startup helper founder. And he knew of me, and I was coming free from a job that I was doing. I was in a proper VC funded startup that had been acquired and smushed by the acquirer. So I was looking for a job. So it was sort of fortuitous timing.
To get into the technical stuff a little bit, what kinds of challenges did you have early on when you first got started?
So if something broke in one part of the app, the whole job queue would get swallowed up and the app would be slow as molasses for everything. Pretty much everything. Like there's still stuff in there that we've thrown money at to solve. So like, you know, the database architecture isn't what it could be. So there's, you know, the classic thing of things being named the opposite of what they are, in the code, but you know, this is all like non-user facing stuff, but it makes it painful to work with. And purely like the growth as well. Like we're 4 times the size on coverage book that we were when I joined. And we are, you know, we have another business on the side. We're running 2 SaaS businesses at the same time. So it's purely a case of what can we do to make our lives sustainable whilst we run these things? So yeah, it's various things like, you know, job queues and database tables getting massively out of hand and jobs they used to run overnight to ensure the consistency of the data and test suites taking half an hour and pretty much all the things you get from a successful business built on software. Yeah. So like you get the successful business and then you're like, oh man, and now we have all of this legacy code, because you know the definition of legacy code is code that makes money.
Right. Yeah, so, it's kind of funny. The world's reward for solving problems is more problems. It's like, oh hey, right, I see you solved that problem. Here's like a different problem that you need to solve now. Yeah, which exactly. Is not, you know, a bad thing. It's just life.
Well, I mean, the classic example of that is, you know, I have twins, and I vividly remember getting sort of 18 bottles in circulation to do the milk feeding, and just, you know, getting the cleaning of the bottles and everything, you know, getting set up for the day, and so they'd each have 6 bottles. And then you get to 6 months old and they're like, now we start feeding them real food. And you're like, what? I just got hold of the milk thing. So here's another problem. And, you know, coding is exactly the same. Yeah. I solved this 5 minutes ago. Why am I having to solve it again?
Yeah. It, well, in my work, so just to share a little bit about my situation, I'm coming up on my 2-year anniversary working where I work, which at 36 years old is the longest that I've worked anywhere, which is...
Congratulations.
Thanks. It shows how much of a job hopper that I've been in the past, but I've finally found some people who I like working for. No offense to all those people I've worked for in the past. I like all you guys too.
Not really. just not as much as these new guys.
Right. Obviously some people I like. Some of the people I work for I fucking hate. But at this place, I was the first person who made the first commit, and so the whole app is me for like 2 years worth of code, and that's been a pretty interesting experience because I haven't had to like deal with anybody else's BS and being like the like antisocial, difficult to work with person that I am, that has been like a dream. And it also means that like any problems that exist in the app, I have nobody to blame but myself, which in a way is also good, because then I can like, a problem arises and like, oh, I know what the problem is there because I did that 6 months ago and now I know. And it's been interesting to like watch my own style evolve just in that, you know, sometimes you feel like you have nothing more to learn about coding style, and then 6 months passes and it's like, oh, wait a second, I'm looking at this code I wrote 6 months ago and this is actually bad. Like, I know of a much better way to do this now.
I mean, I think one of the things that I noticed through my career in coding is that you find yourself sort of falling in love with styles, or, you know, there'll be the 2 years that you try and do everything in a particular style. And Ruby is such a bendy language that it lets you do stuff in weird ways. You know, basically, you know, there's nothing, there's no one quite as in love with design patterns as somebody who's just read the design patterns book. And then you just start applying them wherever you can apply them. And they aren't necessarily a good idea. Sometimes doing the simplest thing is the right idea, or repeating code is also the right idea until you know that you need to sort of abstract it away. Certainly like, you know, premature abstraction and I'm going to do this now because I know I'm going to need this later. And then, you know, you don't use it, you know, the customers don't use that particular part of the app and you got to rip the whole thing out. So yeah, it's having that experience is definitely something that opens your mind to, there's probably reasons why people did this before. And the reason that, you know, the reason for lots of the stuff in our app is they were desperately trying to build features so that people could use the software and then pay them. So I have nothing but respect for any legacy code that I come across. There's no such thing as stupid code that makes money.
That's an interesting take. There's no such thing as stupid code that makes money.
It can be painful, don't get me wrong. Like, you know, having to modernize that or make it scale to 2,000 people when it was only serving 15. Yeah, absolutely. Like, you might make those decisions differently, but this is a great thing I came across the other day, which is when you're buying something for yourself, like you're buying a tool, I don't know, or a saucepan or something, like you should buy the cheapest tool you can find. And if you break it, then you should buy the most expensive one you can afford because you've been using it, and therefore you should then spend money on the thing, because that stops you buying expensive tools you'll never use, or working your way up a series of increasingly expensive versions of a thing. So like, yeah, the heuristic to use is like, buy a really cheap one, see if you break it through use. And then if you do break it through use, get a really good one, which I quite like.
Yeah.
There's definitely parallels in software there.
Yeah. To translate it into like the terms that I think in, like, if you're going to buy a guitar, maybe just buy like $100 guitar as your first guitar. Yeah. And then if you actually play it, then buy like a $1,500 guitar. Don't buy a $300 guitar and then an $800 guitar. Just get the expensive one after you know it. But if you don't ever end up playing your guitar, then, well, you only wasted $100.
You wasted $100, yeah.
That reminds me of something else to bring the parallel to coding, and I don't know if this is what you meant by it or not, but I've been thinking about technical debt lately. And I like to use a different metaphor of like a sharp or a dull saw blade, and like poorly written code is a dull saw and well-written code is a sharp saw. And I like that one a little better in certain ways, because unlike real debt, it's impossible not to incur technical debt. Because like, even if you write really good code, the code base grows, and like, you're going to need to go back and do refactoring. Like, if you never do refactoring, then the code just gets worse and worse. Refactoring is necessary in order to keep things good. And so it's impossible not to accumulate that technical debt. You owe yourself that refactoring. And so I think of it in this saw blade term, like if you keep coding and coding and coding without refactoring, that's like your saw is getting duller and duller. And when you refactor and make everything nice again, then you've sharpened that saw. But something that I've come to realize lately is that not every saw needs to be sharp. So you can imagine your code base as like a garage full of all these saws. And it's actually okay to have a handful of your saws be really dull and crappy, because maybe you'll never even pick up that saw again. So I don't worry too much about making the code in an area super great. I don't spend an extraordinary amount of time polishing that area. But then if I come back, and this is where it comes back to your metaphor or whatever, if I come back and I need to change that area, I won't suffer through and make the change in this messy area. I'll say, wait a second, I'm coming back to this area. This is an area that actually does receive change. So I'm going to go back and sharpen this saw, refactor this code and make it nice, then apply my change now that I've made it easy to do.
Yeah, I mean, the best metaphor I've ever come across for this was Sarah May gave a talk at Brighton Ruby a number of years ago called Livable Code. She sort of compared houses. So when you sell a house, the pictures show it without any belongings in it. And then she compared it to like hoarders who, you know, you just pile their houses high with enormous amounts of stuff so you can barely get anything done. And you wouldn't want to live in either of those houses. You want to live in a house that is, that works for you. So there's some messy bits and then there's some tidy bits, and like which bits are messy and which bits are tidy depends on how you want to live. And like, it's all about living with the code base that you are in. So yeah, that's a really lovely talk and a brilliant metaphor for sort of the ongoing maintenance of a code base that you're sort of involved in day to day.
Yeah. Yeah. That does seem like a good metaphor. Because that's probably the reality of most code bases, is like, it's not universally clean or uniformly terrible throughout the whole thing. It's some areas are cleaner and some areas are more messy.
Yeah. And sometimes you have to clean around the real mess in order to be able to attack the real mess.
Yeah. Yeah, that is true also. Okay. Well, we're coming up on time. So I'm going to ask you the last question that I ask everybody, which is, where can people go to find you online?
So I'm on Twitter, Andy Kroll, benefits of a fairly unique surname. And andykroll.com is where I post my fortnightly writings, which in talking to you, I'm sort of recommitting to getting back in the driver's seat and actually shipping some of those things. Whilst I was running the offline version of Brighton Ruby this year, I somewhat neglected my writing duties. So yeah, back to one Ruby thing. At andykroll.com, I suppose.
Great. Well, by the way, I have a page on my website. It's this ongoing little project I have called the Rails with Jason World Tour. And I'm seeing how many countries I can get guests from. So I'm going to be glad to add England to the list. You're the first guest representing the country of England. I have so far Argentina, Canada, France, Germany, India, Russia, the United States, and now England. So you're doing your duty for your country.
Excellent. That's always good news. I'll put you in touch with some Singaporeans as well. So that should be able to broaden your scope somewhat.
Oh, awesome. That'll be great. Well, Andy, it's been great talking with you. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks a lot.